91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour, we visit with someone who would scoff at the thought of being an author. How could a minimum wage worker with two kids connect with a publisher? Good afternoon. It's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Linda Tirado shows just how exceptional it is for one below the poverty line to get a break. She's endured the numbing life of working two, perhaps three, meaningless jobs with no benefits. Even a needed trip to the dentist is a mere dream, while the numbers of low-wage workers steadily increase. Linda Tirado has written Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. That's Topical Currents coming up. First, NPR and regional news.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Today we discuss what our guest says is the real life for millions of poor Americans. Even those once considered in the middle class easily can wind up a member of this desperate group. They struggle daily just to squeak by.
We'll speak with Linda Tirado, who caught a big break after she wrote a poignant online response which went viral. Its popularity resulted in this book, Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. And she joins us via Skype from London, England. I hear a little bit of noise there.
2 seconds. Hey, guys. We're live on air.
Are you on, Linda?
You sure are.
Okay. I understand WLRN's not, our listeners aren't the only ones that are listening to this broadcast. Tell us what's happening.
I actually have a live audience in London right this very second, and everybody's getting settled in. So we're pleased to be on air.
Okay, it's a live audience in London. They're getting settled in, so I guess that's what the noise is about. Linda, in case for those who don't know, well, first of all, congratulations on your book. If you would, tell us about the nature of the online forum to which you were responding and the circumstances that drove you to write your response.
Right. So I'm actually an internet commenter and have been for years, and there's a website called Gawker. And on the back pages of that website, there's a bunch of user forums. So I'd come home from work one night, and I had had a really long shift, and one of my friends just posted a question about how she'd gone to the grocery store, and she saw somebody with an iPhone and food stamps. And she said, I'm an upper-middle-class liberal. I know I'm not supposed to be angry about that. Somebody explain to me why that is. And I was about two beers in, and I thought, well, I know the answer to that one. And I basically told her that you don't get to make those decisions. You don't get to make those judgments from outside. You can't say, I see you for 5 seconds that one time, and so I know everything I need to know about your life and your moral situation. That we are autonomous adults, whether we have money or not, whether we are well paid or not, and you don't get to make those calls. And then about 10 million people later, it was viral.
Okay, now you received, as you say, lots of reactions to your post, and we know it went viral, and it was on the front page of the Huffington Post, and Forbes, and Nation picked it up. Now, the responses were both positive and negative. Describe them generally for us.
I will say that the positive responses that I got were mostly in solidarity. It was other people who were working saying, yes, that's exactly the thing. That's precisely what you're supposed to be doing. And the negative responses that I got were from people who said, how dare you make excuses for yourself? How dare you call out a system instead of saying that you just weren't doing it right?
Describe the inherent stress, Linda, of not ever knowing really when some crisis is going to befall you and put you behind the eight ball and having to even choose whether to eat or not.
Well, I mean, we know, actually, that kind of stress on your brain causes what they call decision fatigue. It actually decreases your mental capacity. We compare it to a middle-class person losing two nights of sleep. So So if you happen to be lucky enough to have a normal job and you work 40, 50, 60 hours a week even, you're working in the creative class, you want to know what it's like to be poor. Don't sleep tonight. Don't sleep tomorrow. Go to work the third day and tell me how well you function. That's what it's like every single day of our lives. More than that, we work in the service industry, and we know that when you perform happiness for a living, it actually decreases your ability to feel that happiness because it blunts that emotional impact. So what we're doing essentially is creating a class full of overtired, unhappy people who are literally incapable sometimes of feeling hope or joy, and then asking them why they're not a little happier about their situation.
Now, going back to what you just said before about the negative responses, that you weren't taking responsibility, and that you readily admit that some of your situation was your responsibility, that you made some mistakes and bad choices, as perhaps everyone does. And you say some bad luck was thrown in, but where does one's personal responsibility end and where does it become the fault of a broken system?
I think that when you have a broken system, you do not start with personal responsibility. You fix the system and then you go back to those individuals that are still having trouble and saying, what is the problem individually? To start with individual troubles, to start with individual decisions, when we know that, for example, if I developed a drug problem and when I was 18, my parents are wealthy, they send me to rehab, I take a gap year, nobody ever knows about it, I'm still going to go back to school and get that good job. I develop that drug problem when I'm 18, my parents don't have the money to cover for me, I'm going to wind up on the streets, I'm going to be an addict, that's going to be my future. So when we're talking about mistakes, when we're talking about responsibility, when we're talking about autonomy, we have to look at how the system is set up to help those individuals. And if it isn't, you cannot blame them for not getting the help that they need, whether that be addiction, whether that be depression, whether that be the inability to find a job in a time of austerity and unemployment. You cannot blame an individual failing to succeed in a system that is set up to make sure that a vast majority of individuals fail for the benefit of very few.
You mentioned that you think it's more demoralizing to work and be poor than not work and be poor. I guess when you're working and still poor, you're tired on top of things.
Well, it's not even that. It's that if you can't find work, you expect to be poor. You're not working, you have no income, of course you're poor. Mm-hmm. That's fine, that's expected. If you're working three jobs and you still can't pay your electric bill, that's incredibly demoralizing. Why even bother at that point?
Linda, you spoke of several vicious cycles inherent in poverty. I'd like to go over some of them, such as not being able to afford healthy foods, therefore getting sick, but unable to afford the time or money for medical care, or being without a car, having to take buses or walk, and not arriving to work on time, and then losing your job. Would you talk about some more of these vicious cycles that are inherent in your life and the life of others?
Yeah, for example, I graduated high school when I was 16 years old. Went off to college, promptly did as well as a 16-year-old on their own was probably going to do. And at a certain point, I'd taken out $20,000 in student loans, and I was still failing my classes because I was still, 17 and a half, 18 years old. So I made the decision to take a few years off and not to take out those loans, not to take on that debt until I was sure that I was mature enough to handle the responsibility. And as it turns out, it's a terrible idea to go away from school for a few years and think you're going to come back if the economy is going to collapse in the interim. And so what I found myself doing was trapped in a series of downward spirally service jobs where I got, I'll be a cashier, I'll be a bartender, it'll get me through. And then my resume constricted, and that was all that was on it, and that was all people would hire me for. And then suddenly you don't have any money and you can't afford to look good enough to go get hired at a nice place as a secretary, because who the hell wants a poor person to be the face of their company? Nobody. So you find yourself with your choices restricted and ever, ever more so. And the harder you struggle to get out of it, the more you realize that there is no getting out of it. This is your future. This is going to be forever. Vacations are not for people like you. And when you've done that, it's very hard to come up with the mental wherewithal to say, but, I'm going to be the one that succeeds against all odds. Never mind that I'm working at Burger King or McDonald's or Wendy's or Walmart. Never mind that I'm working two essentially part-time meaningless jobs and collecting food stamps, which is so what I wanted to do when I was seven. Like, that's the thing I always said I wanted to do when I grew up. and you find yourself there, and eventually you just learn to accept it because it's easier than fighting. So the biggest poverty trap that we run into is that to tell somebody you have to keep hoping, you have to keep hoping because otherwise you're doing it wrong, but we will never reward that with anything like an actual success. We will never let you forget your station. We will never let you forget what you're supposed to be doing that you're doing wrong. But, you know, keep a stiff upper lip, chin up, work harder, and maybe you'll get the magic. I went viral and got a book deal, and now I'm talking to you internationally from London in front of a live audience who graciously is letting you ask all of the questions that they would have asked me. And I'm telling you this. This is no way to run an economy. This is no way to run a system. You can't take one of us and elevate me and say, well, look at Linda. It happened for her. It could happen for you, too. The American dream was never supposed to be loud. It was never supposed to be Hollywood. It was that if you work hard every single day, you'll be able to provide for your family, and you'll have the time to go home and eat that dinner with your family. And then on top of that, if you are ambitious and you are smart and you are lucky, then you become Marilyn Monroe. This is no way to provide hope for 45 million people who are working in low-wage jobs in America. We can't all get book deals.
I want you to speak, Linda, about that hopelessness and the depression and the difficulties in obtaining, at least when you wrote the book, medical care for the depression and the hopelessness and coping with this adversity day in and day out.
There is no medical care. There is no mental health care. There is nobody that is there to make sure that the working classes get the same sort of medication that the creative classes or that the upper classes do. What we are told is to suck it up, because our lives aren't that bad, really. We have simple jobs. We have simple requirements, and we can barely function on those. Why should we medicate you? Why should we give you therapy? Your life isn't worth that much. If you're lucky, you can find a clinic. If that clinic is a good clinic, you might find therapy that helps you. But more, just as often, when I've gone to seek help, and let me tell you what kind of pride suck up that has to be, you have to suck your pride up and say, I need that help. You have to go and beg. And then, if you're lucky, they'll have a program that helps you. Last time I went in for help, I said, listen, I'm having a rough time. I'm barely sleeping. I'm holding down two jobs. My kid's been college-y for 6 solid months. I just need something to get me through my day. They said, well, we're going to give you intensive in-person group therapy. And I said, my problem is I don't have any time. How is 10 hours of therapy a week going to help me when my problem is that I don't have enough time to get everything done in? And they said, well, that's the program we offer. So either you want to enroll or you don't. But if you don't want the help, then you really need to take responsibility for that decision. Mm. As though the help they offered me was helpful.
We're speaking with Linda Tirado. She's a self-described average American and mother of two, and she's written Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. On today's Topical Currents, we need to take a short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. And we resume our conversation with Linda Tirado. She's the author of Bootstrap America, Hand to Mouth. Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. Sorry for that, Linda. What I'd like to know also...
Much worse has been said than my book title.
What's the worst job that you've taken in the last 5 years or so?
In the last 5 years?
3 years.
Okay. Well, that actually narrows it down quite a bit. In the last 5 years, I'm going to say the worst job that I had was managing a fast food restaurant.
Mm-hmm. And actually, a shift manager maybe gets a dollar or two more an hour, but then they have to put up with all the other stuff and the complaints.
Yeah. No, shift managers, actually, it's kind of nice being a shift manager because you still get overtime. If you're a restaurant manager, you're on salary. So the last time I managed a restaurant, I made $28,000 a year. That was 90-hour weeks. I got 8 days of maternity leave after giving birth to my second child. I had no medical care. I had no sick leave. I had no benefits. And I really spent most of my days wishing I was a shift manager because those guys were bringing home about twice what I did in a paycheck.
Linda, I want to talk about some of the stereotypes that you dispel, some of the myths about the poor that you talk about in your book. There were those for whom you blew apart the stereotype just to begin with that says that poor people can't be intelligent or articulate. So
it was actually one of the criticisms I got. The first thing people said is, you know big words, how could you be poor? And that's a direct quote. I can point it out to you on the internet in probably 100 places. We are not stupid. We are not lazy. We are not shiftless. We are not any of the negative describers that we use any more than the general population is, which is to say you can find as many lazy rich people as you can find lazy poor people. I defy you to explain to me how somebody holding down three jobs is lazy. Anybody who can do that much logistics is not stupid. We might be uneducated. We might be unmannered. We might be unlettered, we might be unsophisticated, but we are not dumb. We see what is going on, and we understand that we are being trapped within this system. There is no good answer to these things, but to just take an entire third of the country and write them off as useless and worthless is one of the most un-American, unethical, and immoral things I've ever heard in my life.
We'd like to engage our listeners here. Are you living from paycheck to paycheck, or do you know of those who do? Do you feel as though you're living on the edge or one crisis away from poverty or homelessness, or have you come from impoverished situation? You can call us, our number, 1-800-743-9576, and speak with Linda Tirado, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@WLRN.org.
Linda, what kind of hoops did you have to go through to get food stamps and other government aid?
Before or after I disclosed my personal medical history to a stranger that looked me up and down and judged me for my sex life? Because there was a bit of that.
Oh.
There was also provide us documentation of all the income that you have. Also provide us documentation of all the places that you went to try to find work. Provide us documentation of everything. Give us your bank accounts. Give us your statements. Tell us about your financial history. Make sure that we have every detail that we need to be sure that you've done everything that you can before you debased yourself enough to come into the food stamp office, and then maybe you can eat food. So that's pretty much the way the system works. It's designed to make sure that we're not giving a penny to anybody that isn't as low as possible, because otherwise we'd be rewarding bad behavior, like wanting to eat.
Now, Linda, I want to mention here that you elaborate on the fact that those who receive welfare or food stamps aren't the only people receiving government subsidies. In fact, you say we all are in one way or another. Would you explain that?
Mortgage tax credits. If you are middle class and you have a mortgage, you actually can deduct all of the interest from your mortgage off of your taxes, and the United States taxpayer will pick up that bill. If you are a business owner, or even if you're an employee, and you take a free martini business lunch with a client and you, at Ruth's Chris, take it to the nicest steakhouse in town, run up a $500 bill, the United States taxpayer will cover that expense. If you decide to renovate your home and add value and put a home office in, the United States taxpayer will cover that expense. But you know what we don't want to do is make sure we're not giving food or medical or dental or vision to the very poor, because they haven't earned it yet. The only people who have earned it are the people who already have the money. And that's before we start talking about corporate taxes. That's before we start talking about bailouts. That's before we start talking about the fact that we subsidize Walmart to the tune of $6.3 billion a year, so that they can keep their prices down and their profits high. So when we're talking about how much money we spend in taxpayer subsidies, let's talk about Boeing. Let's talk about Lockheed. Let's talk about Goldman. Let's talk about all of these things and understand that we live in a society, we all pay in, we all take out, and just because it doesn't look the same, because it doesn't come as a cash benefit on an EBT card that you can spend on food, doesn't mean you're not getting free government cheese. Dude, we all drive on roads. We all use boats and bridges and trains and the internet. We all use phone services. All of these things are paid for and subsidized by the government to a large extent.
Let's take a telephone call or two. This is Matt in West Palm Beach. Hi there.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I just wanted to leave a comment and pose a question. I just wanted to say at first, when I heard you come on the air and you were prompting the discussion, I was actually a little aggravated, and I thought to myself, this is just another person who was living the hard life, got a book published, and now they're going to be up on the top just like all the rest of the people who've got money and living that lifestyle. But I really think you're onto something, and I hope my question was that I hope that you are going to go mainstream and possibly maybe get some offers where you can get your voice out a little further into the nation, so that's just not on public radio. I mean, I love WLRN, but you know, let's face it, not a lot of people listen to public radio all the time. But
actually, Matt, she has gone quite a bit on mainstream media, haven't you?
Oh, I
did Bill Maher. I did Real Time with Bill Maher, and I definitely have been published in a bunch of places, which is awesome. But you know, hey, I'm with him. Put me on more TV shows and let me yell more at people. This is great.
Linda, we have an emailer, and I really want to read this because this is something you do address in your book. It's from Tori. She says, I have a great deal of sympathy for what you're saying. I work with families who have become suddenly homeless due to circumstances she describes. But I did come to a screeching halt in my listening when she mentioned having her second child. She's obviously a very smart woman, smart enough to know that having the right to have a child does not mean that it's the compassionate thing to do for herself, but much more importantly for her child. Poverty tends to cycle from generation to generation. If she hadn't gotten the book deal, history tells us that her children's future was almost sealed into poverty. It makes me angry that people can't stop and recognize that the choice to have children can be a very selfish choice. Now, you talk about this at great length in your book, or you address it. Please respond to Tori.
Yeah. Hi. Tori, I'm going to say directly, I think it's fascinating when people think they understand the timeline of somebody else's life based off of 700 or 800 words they heard about them that one time. To begin with, I became pregnant, and then we became truly impoverished. After my husband came home from Iraq, we moved to Cincinnati for him to go to school on his GI Bill, and the government failed to make those payments. That is when we hit the downward slide and became truly impoverished because the veterans did not get taken care of. Now, secondly, we were not still that low when we had our second child, and to assume that we were is to assume that I'm kind of stupid and can't take care of myself or my family. Thirdly, even if I was that impoverished, it is none of your business whether or not I am further procreating. And if you work with the homeless, I would beg you to please develop more empathy and compassion for your clients, because these are people with families. We have children for the same reason that rich people do, which is to say our family felt unfinished. And whether or not we felt like we were able to take care of that child that minute, what you're saying is that if right now you are homeless, if right now you are low, you will never do better. We do not have magic crystal balls. We know that for a middle-class family to raise a child to the age of 18 and put them through college costs $280,000 in America right now. So if we're going to start regulating the uteruses of the poor, then I am going to actually need every middle class and upper class person to give me a certified statement saying that they have $280,000 per child on hand before they're allowed to procreate either. When we start talking about who is allowed to have a family and what that family looks like, based on the amount of money you make, we are going onto a slippery slope. We have been here before. You do not sterilize poor women against their will because you don't think they should breed. That is immoral. It is unethical. It is inhuman. And it's not something that we in America are supposed to want. What we are supposed to want is to take somebody who is in that situation and say, how do we give you a job that actually pays enough that you can take care of your family? Not say, how can we make sure that you accept that your job will never pay you enough to take care of a family? That's two different ways of looking at the same question. But never, never look at the outside of somebody's life and assume that you have any idea of their rationale when it comes to a decision as personal as whether or not to bear children. It's simply none of your business.
You were listening to Linda Tirado. She's the author of Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. Another short break. We'll come back and take more of your calls. Stay with us.
And we resume Topical Currents on this Tuesday. Bonnie Berman, Joseph Cooper, and also Linda Tirado. She's joining us from London. We're talking about her book, Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. Linda, how about the long-term effect on your children? Do you think there will be lasting effects on them?
I think that any child raised in any situation by any family has lasting impacts. And I think that our job as parents is not to provide them with the biggest and the best and the brightest toys. It's to provide them with love and support. It's to make sure that they grow into autonomous individuals who do not define themselves by what job they hold, but they define themselves by their skills and their loves and their dreams and their ambitions. I'm telling you this. I have a 2- and a 4-year-old. They don't care whether or not there's a brand on their ball or their coloring books. The rainbow that you paint on their wall can be crooked and made out of crappy paint. They will not notice. They see the rainbow and they dream. Dreams are not reserved for the wealthy. And your job as a parent is to make sure that your children are allowed to dream. So I don't understand when people say, well, you're poor. How can you possibly be a good parent? Well, I can turn that back on you and say, look, you're wealthy and you exploit people for a living. How can you possibly be a good parent? At least I have the moral high ground of having been exploited. And I understand what that feels like, and I can teach them to overcome that. I feel bad for children who are so coddled that they're not allowed to skin their knees, and they're never allowed to misbehave, and they never learn to play with sticks.
And play
dates. That's childhood, as far as I'm concerned.
I just want to explain that, yes, Linda is joining us live from London, England, and that's a live audience. So when you hear some noise in the background, that's what you're hearing.
Let's take another telephone call. This is Larry in Boynton Beach. Hey, Larry.
Hey, how are you all doing? Really, I really appreciate the opportunity to be a part of this discussion. First of all, Linda, kudos, you know, up and down and all around. For a minute, I thought that the sound there was me clapping. So apparently there's other people that was doing that. To give a different perspective in corroboration of Linda's book, I teach college and university, and to be able to make a career in academics, especially as an adjunct professor, you know, it's really truly ridiculous to think that people who live hand to mouth, people who worry every month that they're going to be able to pay their mortgage and pay their bills, are lacking in some way. I think just speaks to the arrogance and the narcissism and the overinflated sense of entitlement that has really taken root in our society. The values that Ms. Tirado was just talking about in terms of how we should be raising our kids are not the values that we're raising kids with. It's an every man for himself, dog eat dog. I got mine, so screw you. Get yours any way that you can. And, you know, this is now what we're really calling the American spirit. And if I can push the boundaries just a little bit more, I find it incredibly ironic, if not just a little disturbing, that the people who are the most adamant and emphatic about not taking care of people in need and acknowledging that there are people that need help, out and out refusing to help them, are the ones that brag the most about being the biggest Christians. So there's a real disconnect between rhetoric and reality.
Linda?
To begin with, the fact that adjunct professors are living homeless is a giant problem. If you go and you get the education and you are a teacher, you are a professor at a university, you should not be making wages that make you homeless. But we see this over and over. I personally know PhDs that are homeless that teach college, university, a big name university even. As to the point about Christianity, I'm going to say this. You're going to find hypocrites everywhere you go. Some of them are going to be Christians. Some of them are not. I come from Utah. It's Mormon country. I was raised to a Baptist school. I was raised as a religious fundamentalist, basically. And I know hypocrites, but I also know people who are good people who follow their scriptures, whatever they may be, with passion and intensity. And I say, Ephesians 4:32, and be kind unto one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. If you are a Christian and you do not hold to that tenet, you, sir, are no Christian. But simply because somebody calls themselves something doesn't make them one. I would submit that the people who call themselves Christians or Muslims or Jewish or any religious faith who fail to deal with the tenets of their own religion are no members at all. And we cannot hold the rest of the religions accountable for that, because I will say, I have seen religions do good work for the poor. I will tell you, they do better work than the government or private charities. I have seen it with my own eyes. I am grateful every single time. But there's a difference between a church-run charity that exists to help the poor and a charity that is run by a church that is an excuse to proselytize. And we have problems with those too. When I was pregnant with my first child, in seeking prenatal care, I could only find one place that would see me on Medicaid. That place told me I couldn't have an ultrasound until I was 8 months pregnant, even though I was high risk. I told them I was pretty sure Jesus approved of science and wanted me to have an ultrasound, and then I never went back. Because if all you're going to do is ask me how my church home is and give me handouts on taking iron supplements, well, honey, I got Google and I got Jesus when I was five. I'm fine. I got that myself. So we run into an issue of are we giving money to these faith-based initiatives, and are they doing what they need to do, or is it just an extension of their church and their mission? And if that's the case, then more power to you, but let's be honest about it. I have no problem with religious people. I think religious people are fantastic. I have trouble with hypocrisy.
Let's take another call for Linda Tirado. This is Troy. Troy's in Key West. Hey there.
Oh, hey. Thank you for taking my call. And Linda, again, hats off to you and what you're doing. Mine is more of a comment, a question. I guess you can give me some insight on this. But I'm active duty military. I've been in the military now for 24 years. And I know since I've been in the military, I came in at the pay grade of E1, making well below $20,000 a year. And I will say that, you know, since I've been in, there's always been this constant push of saying, okay, for the military member, let's increase the pay scale for the fighting soldier, sailor, whatever the case may be. I'm all for that. My hat's off to my brothers and sisters and what they're doing. But I think there's a disparity, or there's a confusion now in the definition of what we consider to be poor or the poverty level. You know, I think it's more between the have and have nots. You know, since I've been in the military, there's several things that I had to address, like where's my next meal coming from, or where am I going to sleep, or, you know, housing, things like that. Am I going to be homeless the next day? I was all about, the question was, am I going to make the next pay grade? Do I reenlist, or whatever the case may be? And I said, because there's a lot of benefits that are thrown towards the service member, meaning basic allowance for housing, free medical, dental, things like that, that I heard you when you opened up in your opening statement, you know, you didn't receive those things, and it became that slippery slope, I guess the word that you use, I'm not sure, but there was things that it was a constant revolving door, because you didn't have this get good quality food, and you got sick, and then because of not having medical insurance and things like that, it was, you know, it was that domino effect, if you will. Well, a lot of our military members, I will say, I didn't want to accustom to that, but then still, I was being defined as being below the poverty level and being poor. Well, I never considered myself as being poor because of the benefits that came along with the service that I was doing.
Troy, could you let Linda respond to you?
Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, so to begin with, it is, I have nothing but words that you cannot say on public airwaves about the fact that we have active duty military families on food stamps, period. I have nothing but unspeakable words to say about the fact that we are bringing soldiers home from Iraq, from Afghanistan, from weird accidents that they had in training in Japan, and they can't find the help that they need when that is the contract that they signed. We are a nation of contracts. We are a capitalist nation. If you sign a contract, you will uphold it. And for the United States government to fail to do so is both a travesty and a giant, massive problem. Now, when we're talking about the difference between poor and poverty and the military, we are talking about the fact that you can go to the PX, you've got discounted food there, you're given base housing, those things, those benefits are available. But there is no reason that any worker's pay, whether it be military, whether it be police or fire, whether it be somebody at Burger King, there is no reason that any worker's pay in America is failing to keep up with the cost of living. But more, when the United States government is the one signing the paychecks. I married a Marine. He went to Fallujah. He went to Iraq. It ruined our lives. And he came home whole in body, thank God. It's better than a lot of women. It's better than a lot of Marines get. But it needs to be better. And I'm not a military fetishist. I'm not one of the Marines' wives that thinks that the Corps is above God and country and everything. That's not me. But if we are going to ask them to do things that we would not do ourselves, if we are going to say, in exchange for your college benefits, you have to go off and kill brown people in a foreign country, and you have to come home and live with the possibility that you did that, we can at least feed them and their children and their wives, because let me tell you, deployment is no cakewalk.
We're speaking with Linda Tirado, and she's written Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. Our last break on Topical Currents. We will be right back. And we're back with today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Linda Tirado. She's a self-described average American and mother of two. She's written Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. Linda, we have one segment left, and I thought in this last segment I'd like to touch on some things that you would like to see happen or changes that could be made or what people can do. Beginning with, you speak quite a bit about dignity or indignity in terms of jobs that poor people have to take and in terms of the way that poor people are regarded and treated by others. So let's start there and maybe talk about what you'd like to see.
I would like to see people not have to, honestly, what it comes down to is that I define a good job as one in which you do not have to ask your supervisor to evacuate your bowels. If you can pee freely, you've done all right. And I think a lot of people take that for granted, the notion of bodily autonomy even being a thing that we are not allowed. We are not allowed to have emotions. We are not allowed to have human functions. We are not allowed to have our own vocabulary. When we go to work, we're told, you can greet your customers in one of the three following ways. Hi, welcome to whatever restaurant. How can I help you? Hi, welcome to whatever restaurant. What can I do for you today? Hi, welcome to whatever restaurant. Can I get you combo number whatever it is we're promoting that day? And those are your three options. And they send secret shoppers through. And if you don't say one of those three things, you lose points. You lose points, your manager gets in trouble, you lose your job. That is the level of autonomy we're at. We are scripted constantly. There is no such thing as dignity on the bottom, because what you are essentially doing is saying, I will give up my humanity for X amount of hours in a day, and in exchange, I would like less money than it's going to take me to live, please. And then I'm going to spend the rest of my time begging social workers who think that I'm inherently lazy because I only have two part-time jobs, and clearly if I was smart, I would just go to the good job store and get a better job. And then after all of that, I'm going to go home and scrub my house that's never going to be clean enough because I am not home ever. And maybe at the end of that, maybe I'm going to get 5 minutes to myself. Maybe I get that in a day. So when we're talking about dignity, I ask you, what is dignity? Because I haven't had a whole lot of it for about 18 years now. Not until they gave me a book deal, and suddenly everything that I had been saying for that 18 years was magic. You would not believe the response that I get. And I'm not saying anything different than anybody who right now, at this very moment, is in a Walmart, is in a Burger King, is in a Wendy's, is in a McDonald's. They are all saying exactly the same things that I am saying right now. We always have been. We always will be. That this is what we talk about. So tell me, what does dignity even mean? Because it's hard for me to define. Dignity to me is being able to use the restroom without having to ask for permission and explain to somebody that, no, it really is an emergency, like I'm five.
So what changes, though, Linda, would you like to see as a result of your notoriety, your newfound notoriety, and your success now? If you could, if there were policy changes you could see in place, what would they be? Other than what you've just said.
Nothing changes because of my notoriety. If I hope anything changes, it's not policy-wise because there is no government solution. We have rules to protect us in the workplace. The trouble is nobody cares about them because we're all in at-will states. We have no union protections. We have no workers' movement. What I would say that I hope changes as a result of this is that every single other minimum wage worker in the entire country realizes that they have an autonomous voice, that they are grown adults that are making rational decisions based on the factors that are presented to them, and that they stop feeling ashamed. If it were up to me, if I could pass a law, it would be that everybody had to tell their bosses precisely what their jobs felt like, that everybody told their neighbors precisely what their lives felt like. Because the trouble that we have is that nobody's listening. We talk to each other. We never talk outside our class. We're supposed to be ashamed of ourselves. We're supposed to feel like we're the ones at fault. If I could change anything, it would be to make people realize that if you can't find a job in an economy with super high unemployment, it probably isn't because you're inherently lacking. If you fail to find a good job in an economy that's built on an increasingly service sector where we're in a race to the bottom on wages, it's probably not because you lack inherent intelligence or skill. You are as valuable and as worthwhile as any CEO, as any manager, as any creative professional. I am living proof that you can be a writer and have absolutely no training or, you know, real skill. I have raw talent, but let me tell you, I'm a night cook from nowhere, Utah, all right? And this is what they let me do, and here is how well I'm doing. And if I could change anything, it would be to tell everybody who is working in the service industry, anybody who's listening to this, if you got the same shots I did, you'd be doing as well or better. This is a matter of luck. Where you live, what you do, how well you're doing is a matter of luck as much as it is an innate ability or skill or talent.
Describe, Linda Tirado, how in the book you mentioned that you need to have anger just to survive. Could you make that a little clearer?
If you're not angry, you're probably going to kill yourself. I mean, look, I make jokes. I make terrible, terrible, awful jokes. That's how we get through, with gallows humor. And I'm going to tell you, any minimum wage worker will tell you the same thing. But if you're not angry at the system, you collapse within yourself because you blame yourself and you realize that if it's not them, it must be me, because something is causing this misery. Something is causing the way that we live. Something is moving the society. And if it's not them, it must be me. Anger is the antidote to depression. So when people say, why are you so angry? I say, well, I prefer it to depression. I prefer to be angry at a system that constricted my movement and promised me it was free than I prefer to be angry at myself and feel as though I'm not worth anything simply because I haven't managed to rise above a situation that was inherently built to make sure that I could not.
Yeah, let's take another telephone call. We're a little bit short on time, but we'll go to Sunny in West Palm Beach. Hi there.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Oh, this is for me, Sunny?
Yes.
Hi. First of all, I want to say, Linda, bravo for writing this book and for having all this anger and moving everything forward, because I'm a social worker from New York, and I left New York on FMLA, and I was running a group home, and after I left, I was fired. And after the FMLA ended, I lost my job. And then trying to get any kind of government assistance, and I'm also Caucasian, so So every time I walked into an office, they looked at me and they asked me point blank, what are you doing here? Why aren't you working? They treated me horribly. And I've been on both sides of the fence, and I just love your passion. I'm wondering, where is the humanity? Why do we have to grovel? A friend of mine in New York is going through the same thing. She was working with me. She lost a position. She couldn't get food stamps because she was getting unemployment. They said she was making too much money. They don't look at your expenses. We were just having this conversation last night. They don't seem to care. It's just we're nickeled and dimed to death, like that book from when it was, I think,
yes,
in the 80s.
Actually, well, Barbara Ehrenreich's been on the program, and she lives in the Keys. She listens a lot to
Well, but also Barbara Ehrenreich wrote the foreword
right.
to this book, yeah. Sonny, Hand to Mouth.
Barbara's fantastic. I love her. Can I make a point here, though?
Yes.
We're talking about, she said, you go into the welfare office and your white and they ask you what you're doing here. I would like to address that. Because 10%, something between 10 and 13% of the American population is African American. But funny, we always think that people on welfare are black. And it turns out the vast majority of the United States population is white, and therefore the vast majority of welfare recipients are also white. And we do not all live in trailer parks. We do not all look like you think we do, because when you were talking, and again, one-third of the country, 145 million Americans are in this low-wage trap and qualify for these benefits, we don't look like anything. There is no box you can put 45 million people in. We are fat, we are thin, we are tall, we are short, we are black, we are white, we are purple with pink polka dots. It doesn't matter. There are 45 million of us. Find a descriptor and you'll find a poor person that looks like that.
Linda, who do you want to read your book? Because we're coming to the end of our program. Who would you like ideally to read your book?
Anybody who thinks that they're better than the person serving them their burger. Because at the end of the day, it comes down to respect. I would like people to say thank you instead of screw you. I would like people to understand that the toilets still need to be scrubbed, no matter whether or not we would like to look at the toilets. They still need to be scrubbed. And maybe we could look at the people doing the scrubbing and say thank you for taking that task off my hand and for taking thankless, joyless work and making the economy run, instead of looking at them and saying, wow, you must be pretty worthless if this is all you can do for a living. That's the difference in attitude I would like to see. That's the change that I'd like to create. And that is where we need people to stand up and talk for themselves and demand their own humanity back. If we're going to talk about dignity, then I say we start demanding some. Nobody is going to give it to us. So I say, if you work in the service sector, read my book. If you employ people in the service sector, read my book. If you work in the service sector, honey, I ain't going to look twice at you if you hit the torrents. I mean, it is what it is. The internet exists. But if you are wealthy enough that you feel like you would never get stuck at that stupid service industry job, you've got $20. Buy the book, read the book, and then leave it at a McDonald's so that the service workers can read it too.
Well, Linda, we want to thank you. Linda Tirado is, well, in response to an online forum, she posted a response, Why I Make Terrible Decisions or Poverty Thoughts, which went viral and became this book, Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. Wish we had more time, but we want to thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. Have a great evening.
Thank you.
You too.
Bye-bye. Whoa. And that wraps up today's Topical Currents. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Once again, we have free audio archives of this and previous programs at our website, WLRN.org. You can also browse to the Topical Currents Facebook page for important links, photos, discussions, and more. Tomorrow at this time, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. Both Bonnie and I will be back Thursday with Linda Gassenheimer, Fred Tasker, in a program which highlights new gadgets which could make holiday gifts. This is Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.